Welcome, everyone, to the Cornell Veterinary Podcast, where we do a deep dive into the discovery, care, and learning that happens at Cornell University's College of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Dr. Michelle Moyle, a general practitioner and lover of all things Cornell Vet. And so we're here in this episode talking to another amazing Cornell faculty member, Anushka Dongre, Dr. Anushka Dongre. I am very excited you're here, and I'm going to get started by reading your just, you know, really simple bio. I mean, you haven't been doing anything with your life. You've just been hanging out, clearly not doing much. But Dr. Dongre is an assistant professor in the Department of Biomedical Sciences. She obtained her Bachelor's of Science and Master's of Science degrees in microbiology from the University of Mumbai, India, and her PhD at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She did her postdoctoral training at the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research at MIT. Oh yeah, no, you haven't been doing much. You've just been, and MIT, excuse me. You can feel free to elaborate further. I would love to hear more. Welcome. I'm very excited you're here.
Thank you so much, Michelle. I mean, thank you for having me. This is my first podcast, so I'm really excited myself.
Same, girl, same. And your hair looks great. I'm hoping my curls are really showing up on video. But we're going to jump right in, if that's okay.
Yeah, sounds great.
So it's really important to me to kind of ask about people's origin stories. What made you decide to become a scientist?
Yeah, so it's a long story. As you heard from my bio, I'm originally from Mumbai in India. And I think that's where my passion for science started. I just loved biology in school. I like learning about it in the classes. And so there was like a natural affinity towards the sciences and wanting to learn more.
Totally get that.
It was just a thirst for knowledge and wanting to learn more that allowed me to, you know, get into science and think about science as a profession. You know, a lot of people told me I should consider being an MD or a doctor, because if you're good in biology, the first thing that comes to your mind is maybe you should be a doctor instead. But I was fortunate enough to have mentors who exposed me to the world of research very early on. And so my first experience working in a lab was when I was a master's student, and I did it in a small lab in India. And that was, you know, my first experience working at the bench, holding a pipette, thinking about asking questions that are going to make a difference, and thinking about how organisms just function, you know, the basic biology without thinking much about translation. And that is what sparked my interest in science. I took a class in immunology. Eventually, I liked immunology very much, and I thought I'm going to dedicate the rest of my graduate career towards learning immunology. And so that's why I applied to graduate school in the United States, and I got into UMass Amherst. And I joined Barbara Osborne's lab. She is an immunologist and she works on CD4 T cells. And so I was studying these signaling pathways in the CD4 T cells to understand how they work and how they differentiate to form different types of T cells. And that really gave me a very good understanding of immunology, you know, basic cellular fundamental immunology. And I was lucky to have a very positive and nurturing experience in Barbara's lab. And, you know, there are very few graduate students who will say, oh, I loved my PhD. It was the best thing of my life. It's hard, right? But I'm one of few who can say that. And it's because of this wonderful experience and mentorship that Barbara gave me that really cemented my love for science and wanting to do this for the rest of my life. And so then one thing kind of led to another. I did my postdoctoral work with Bob Weinberg at the Whitehead Institute at MIT. And at the end of my postdoc, doing the work that I was doing, I think I was not ready to leave it just yet. The desire for learning more and exploring some of these fundamental questions just grew exponentially over time.
We all do that, by the way. We all do that. As doctors, we're like, all I want to do is do this. And then you get there and you're like, but couldn't I do more?
Yeah.
We love that. Here's what I recognize when I talk to amazing people at Cornell, just like you, I do catch a theme, and it doesn't matter who it is. It's being drawn into science, like at a young age, even if you didn't think you were going to go into science full term. And then encountering someone who really allowed you to flourish and like develop your passion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what happened to me. And, you know, I cannot stress the importance of having good mentors. You're going to need them throughout your life.
Yes, across the board.
Yes, I had good teachers in school. I had good mentors in India when I was, you know, doing my master's thesis, who gave me opportunities, who took a chance on me. And I couldn't be more grateful for what they've done to me. And I seek out mentors actively. Even now, as assistant professor, you need mentors at every stage of your career.
Oh, yes.
I aspire to be a good mentor to my own students. And I think it makes such a big impact on what you do.
This is just a little side note for students or young people out there. If you have a mentor and that mentor just, you know, you think of them as a mentor, but maybe you don't really like work together like you thought. Maybe you're not thriving as well as you thought. That's okay. They might be able to help someone else and you can find other mentors. So I think sometimes we think, well, this is our person who committed to us, but we can help ourselves by finding our person, just like you were very lucky. It sounds like you found two incredible labs and mentors in your career.
Yeah, and I would say more than two, but
yeah,
absolutely. My thesis advisor, yes, and postdoctoral advisor were the two major players.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No offense to the others that she didn't have time to mention.
Sure.
Okay, I'm leaning in. That's how much I mean it. So you decide to be a scientist, and it seems like your focus, not seems, I stalked your lab online, as one does. Your focus is cancer. But you did study this immunology. So where did you go from loving immunology to deciding that cancer research would be your focus?
Yeah, that's a great question, Michelle. So my lab actually works at the interface of both cancer biology and immunology. But you're absolutely right. I made that transition. I think it was just a series of events. I was at the right place at the right time. And the way I went about making that transition was while I was doing my PhD. I mean, I love immunology, but I also took a cancer biology class. And I was fascinated by what I was learning. And I thought, at the end of my PhD, when I was looking at options to do a postdoc, maybe I wanted to try something new.
So you can do that. You can decide, like you did your whole thing and you're like, I just want to try. Like you're not necessarily confined to your initial study, right?
No, absolutely not. I mean, it's an opportunity to try something new and you're not committing yourself, right? If you like it, you can continue to do it. If not, you can go back to doing what you liked before. And so I didn't want to limit my options. And I thought, why don't I try doing something else and learning this other field of cancer biology that I was also interested in. But at the same time, I like the immunology a lot. And so I thought, perhaps the best situation would be to study both and be at the interface and adopt interdisciplinary approaches. And so I applied to Bob Weinberg's lab for a postdoctoral position, and I joined his lab and started studying the EMT program, which was a major theme and continues to be a major theme in his lab. I'm very glad I got that opportunity because I came in as an immunologist and I had a very different perspective to the problem. And so this process of, you know, epithelial mesenchymal transition, which cancer cells adopt, was studied more in the context of what does it really do to the cancer cells? You know, how do they become resistant? How do they metastasize? And because I came in with a background in immunology, I was curious to understand how does it affect the immune system? And at the time, we really didn't know a lot about it. And there's still so much that's left to learn. And so that's how I made the transition. And it was the best thing I could have done for myself because it opened up all of these different possibilities for me.
And, you know, it's just a testament to say labs and science in general, they don't need someone always who has the same study. We want diversity in thought. Like we want diversity of people, but we want it because of diversity of thought, diversity of how you approach problems. Just for our listeners who might not be familiar with all types of science, could you briefly, in like lay terms, just tell us what immunology is and what that fancy EMT concept is, just like, so we're all on the same page.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, it's a very broad discipline, right? Immunology, study of the immune cells in your body. But I can tell you a little
bit
about what we do. So we look at different adaptive and immune cells in terms of how we can use them to fight cancer.
Oh, wonderful.
And so what happens under normal conditions, right? Your immune system is designed to fight infections, whether it's a bacterial infection, a viral infection. And so these specific types of cells called as T cells get activated and they're able to kill this pathogen, whether it's a viral pathogen or a bacterial pathogen, and then their activity is regulated. So they're turned off and you don't have all of these, you know, unforeseen
makes sense
consequences. And so it's important to have that switch that regulates the activity of these T cells. Now, what happens in the context of cancer progression is exactly the opposite. So you would want the immune system to kill cancer cells, but the cancer cells are able to evade the immune system, use immune surveillance or immune evasion strategies that basically turns off the immune system. So now the immune system starts helping the cancer grow instead of shutting it off. And so my lab is focused, like many other labs, we're trying to use the immune system to fight cancer, which now brings me to the problem of EMT and what is EMT and, you know, how are we connecting these two ideas together? So EMT is called as epithelial mesenchymal transition or epithelial mesenchymal plasticity. And you can think about it as cells that change shape or think about cells being shapeshifters. It's basically epithelial cells that are cuboidal in nature, so they're held together very tightly. And when they activate this EMT program, they basically detach from each other.
So they're kind of like bricks, kind of like tight together.
Sure, absolutely. Cuboidal morphology.
Yep.
They're
or
held
square.
By ectotherin gap junctions, really tight.
Okay, so stuff is sticking them together tight and then
just detach. And
wow.
They adopt this more spindle-shaped or what we call as a mesenchymal morphology.
Okay.
And there are many EMT transcription factors and many, you know, other signaling networks that facilitate.
Sure, tons of stuff involved, yes. But ultimately
they detach, yes.
Detach and change shape.
Yes, absolutely. And it's actually not a binary switch that all epithelial cells become mesenchymal.
Gotcha.
It's in fact a spectrum of states. So you have cells that can co-express both epithelial mesenchymal markers. We call it quasi-mesenchymal. And there's actually this entire series of states. So you can think about the EMT as, you know, shapeshifters would probably be the best way to explain it to people who've never heard about EMT before as a series of cellular changes. And it's an epigenetic process. So cells changing their identity. So
I love the screen just gave you a thumbs up, probably because I was like, that's great. I agree. That was worth a thumbs up. So wow. So this is not just on off. This is maybe some on, maybe some off. Maybe some of them are on with some switches that tell them some different messages. So this is not straightforward. We love this in science. This is great.
Yeah, it's not a black and white process, right? Like everything in science, right? There are layers of complexity.
Oh my God. It just sounds so difficult. Yeah.
And so what's fascinating about cellular plasticity, EMT is a type of cellular plasticity, is it was actually not discovered in cancer cells. This is a process that is a physiological, fundamental biological process. So for instance, it's needed for wound healing. It's needed for embryonic development. If you get a scratch on your skin, so the skin has epithelial cells. And if you have a scratch and you wound your skin, these cells activate the EMT program and they become mesenchymal and motile. So they're able to move across that barrier.
Gotcha.
So this is a process that's actually needed for physiologic functions. And it's hijacked by cancer cells to spread to different parts of the body. And so when cancer cells activate this EMT program, they acquire many characteristics that you would typically associate with aggressive cancers. So they're able to spread in a process called as metastatic colonization. They become resistant to treatments like cytotoxic therapy, chemotherapy. They adopt something called a stem-like potential. So these cells are able to self-renew, make more of themselves, make more of the other type of epithelial cells.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so they gain a lot of characteristics that are associated with aggressive disease. My lab looks at these mesenchymal cells in terms of how they interact with the immune system. What are they doing to the immune system? Do these different cellular states really interact differently with your immune system?
Wow, that's incredible. And I hope, you know, people listening or watching understand that I laughed because medicine is just not straightforward. And I think sometimes people think it is, but it really isn't. And the laugh comes from that like frustrated, like, oh, it gets so technical and so complicated. This is incredible information, but it sounds like it makes cancer so difficult and so invasive. Like, and evasive.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating for us, right? Because it tells you like there is so much, even though the EMT has been studied for years, there's still so much that we don't know.
Yeah.
There's still so much that's left to learn. And we're trying to adopt a very different approach to this problem by trying to look at it from an immunological lens. And, you know, the consequences of activating this EMT program are clearly very wide and very far reaching.
Wow. I saw that the main focus seems to be breast cancer, per your lab. Is there a reason why you chose to work on breast cancer? Is there something about the immunology aspect that lends to breast cancer being a good model for what you're studying? I was just curious.
Great question. One of the reasons why, well, there are several reasons why we're working on breast cancers, but I think one of the major reasons why is because we study the EMT and the immune system also in terms of immunotherapy. So immunotherapy is essentially activating your immune system to kill cancer cells. And there are many different types of immunotherapies. So there's a specific form of immunotherapy called as checkpoint inhibition. And these are basically antibodies that can inhibit negative regulatory interactions on T cells and activate them.
Oh, wait, could you translate that into plain language?
Sure. So as I was explaining to you before, like the activity of T cells is regulated, right? Once done their function, they have to be turned off. But in cancer cells, these T cells are just inactive because of the tumor's microenvironment and what the cancer cell does to the T cell. So you need to activate them again. And this is what the checkpoint antibodies do. They turn on, then they get them to kill the cancer cells. And this form of immunotherapy has actually worked very well for certain cancers. So for instance, you know, patients with melanoma or non-small cell lung cancer, about 60% of them respond quite well to these checkpoint inhibitors. But breast cancer patients do not respond as well. So the response rates for breast cancer patients to a particular form of this checkpoint blockade immunotherapy is about 15 to 30%. So you still have a vast majority of patients that are not deriving benefit. So we call them the non-responders. And this is one of the reasons why we want to work with breast tumors, because we want to potentiate the response of checkpoint inhibitors and, you know, ask the question, how can we increase the fraction of patients who will derive benefit? And so there is an unmet need here, and that is one reason why we want to work with these breast cancers. And then another reason is because as part of my postdoctoral work studying the EMT, I made models that recapitulate these epithelial or mesenchymal state in murine breast tumors, or mouse models of breast cancer.
Sure.
So we have mouse models of breast cancer that are either epithelial or mesenchymal. So we have the tools to ask these type of questions. This is why it's a good start for us to work in this disease area.
So is there just one type of checkpoint inhibitor?
No, there are multiple forms of checkpoint inhibitors because T cells express multiple checkpoints.
Sure.
The ones that are studied very commonly is anti-CTLA-4, and which the discovery of CTLA-4 and anti-CTLA-4 by Dr. Jim Allison and Dr. Honjo received the Nobel Prize.
Oh, just the Nobel Prize? Oh.
And okay. Then you have PD-1 blockade, which is a different type of checkpoint inhibitor.
So when you say non-responders, does that mean that this specific type of breast cancer doesn't respond to any type of checkpoint blockade?
So this is a great question. So the mouse model that we work with and the mesenchymal-like mouse tumors are unresponsive to both forms of checkpoint blockade. However, it is a little different. In patients, there is there are 15 to 30% that do respond. They derive benefit from PD-L1 inhibition, but the vast majority are unresponsive to either CTLA-4 or PD-1 blockade.
Wow. So I'm so intrigued. When you do the research on the checkpoint inhibitors, are you also focusing, or does someone else focus their attention on what might make the responders more responsive?
Yes. So this is a major theme in my lab. And
okay.
Yeah, I'm so glad to ask you this question. This is a major theme.
Amazing.
So one of the things that we want to do is to ask, can we use criteria to predict whether or not somebody is going to respond, right? Because these inhibitors, like any other types of cytotoxic therapy, are associated with side effects. And so a lot of people in the field think about understanding before you administer therapy, is there any way to know, are these going to derive benefit? And what are the criteria that you can use? And my colleagues in the field have really done phenomenal work identifying what these criteria are. So for instance, if you have a tumor that has a lot of T cells inside that tumor, chances are it is going to respond well. But if you have a tumor where you don't see as many T cells, the T cells are excluded from the tumor, chances are it's not going to respond as well. So what we're trying to do is, I talked about epithelial mesenchymal plasticity. So we're trying to ask if the plasticity of the cancer cells can be used to predict whether or not somebody is going to derive benefit. So rather than looking at the immune cells that regulate these responses, we're coming at it from the perspective of the cancer cells and see how the plasticity of cancer cells regulates these responses. And that is what we've been able to kind of phenocopy in a way with our mouse models.
I think that that's so neat, because I think sometimes people tend to forget, when people are doing all of this amazing research, that this can seriously have clinical ramifications. And that's really important to someone like me. You want to be able to tell someone before they take a medication that might make them ill or have all these side effects, whether or not it would work.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the hope. The hope is to translate it to the clinic. Although we didn't start the study that way, that we started thinking about EMT just to understand the basic biology of how it affects the immune system. But clearly it has, you know, translational benefits. And the other reason why we think it's important to think about it from a translational perspective is we have seen differences in terms of the plasticity of the cells and how they respond to checkpoint blockade. So for instance, in our mouse models of epithelial breast tumors, they do in fact respond to a specific form of checkpoint blockade called CTLA-4 inhibition. And our quasi-mesenchymal tumors, so this is the population that's activated the EMT program.
Quasi. Okay. Do you see? I hope everybody's watching me glaze over as I hear all of this brilliance. She said she used a pipette before, and I was like, pipette? Oh, okay. But people love that. Thank goodness for people like you.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. So back to the quasi-mesenchymal.
Yes.
They're resistant to checkpoint inhibition. And what's even more fascinating is if we mix the two cell types together, so we've made a third model, right? Because not all cancer cells in a tumor are mesenchymal. There's heterogeneity from the perspective of the cancer cells themselves.
So they're not all the same, essentially.
No.
There's a lot of difference for people listening. Like, and that's also what makes it difficult, right, to kind of target it.
Absolutely, because you have all of these different cells, not just the cancer cells, but immune cells and multiple other, you know, cells in the tumor microenvironment. And so as long as you have these mesenchymal cells in a mixed tumor, the mixed tumor is also resistant to checkpoint blockade. So epithelial on its own responds, but as long as you start spiking it in with the mesenchymal cells, the epithelial cells fail to respond. So these mesenchymal cells are dangerous. As long as they're present in the tumor as a whole is unresponsive. And so,
wow.
Yeah. So this is what's fascinating for us.
Oh my God. That's so incredibly difficult. And I know, and I'm going to jump to other questions, but can I ask, how, as a scientist, how does it feel sometimes to go into your lab each day and think, this is so difficult. How will I approach this challenge? Like mentally, how do you, this is such a difficult challenge.
I agree with you. It is a difficult question. It was also an unexpected finding when we mixed tumors, right? It was, this is not what we thought would happen, but it happened. And I'm glad it did, because that's what prompted us to ask the next question is, okay, we know these mesenchymal cells are cross-protecting the epithelial cells. How are they doing that?
Yeah.
And it is a difficult challenge, but I do think it opens up the possibility of thinking about it some more and coming up with novel solutions to the problem. If we
Absolutely.
Had answers to everything, there would be nothing left to learn. We view these difficult questions as learning opportunities and think about, you know, what else can we do? How else can we approach these problems to eventually solve them? And because of this unexpected finding, we've started asking, well, what is it that the mesenchymal cells are doing? And we found one target. It's the name of the molecule is CD73. The name doesn't matter, but essentially, if you perturb the expression of this particular enzyme on the mesenchymal cells, we can sensitize them to some form of checkpoint inhibition. But
wow.
We don't know the mechanism.
Gotcha. So essentially, you found this unexpected surprise that if this mixed tumor, it can essentially like confer like protective properties, so nothing affects it. Now you're using something amazing to sensitize them, so then you can make these medications more effective.
Well, hopefully. At least, yes. At least in the mouse model, we need to
upgrade,
and then that can
sure.
stage for future work.
So the goal, again, I'm looking at this like, oh, this challenge seems insurmountable in some cases. But the best part is that you found this unexpected information. You were like, thank goodness we know this now. And now we can ask the right questions so we can build things to help.
Yes, absolutely. I think the models that we established, we don't see the models as the end of the road. Like this is just
yeah.
the beginning. We have all
wow.
of the tools and we can use them to ask these difficult questions and see where what the science teaches us.
That's so neat. Obviously, I hope people are listening, and I don't think the majority of us look at anything and say, this is insurmountable. Each person in science has their own challenges, and we're like, we could do this, right? And so I guess my question is, in what do you hope like your work can do for breast cancer someday? Like what would be like one day you're like, we did this?
I think for us, it's targeting this population of more mesenchymal, quasi-mesenchymal refractory cells. Like this is
yeah.
really the type of cancer cell that's driving not just resistance to chemotherapy, but these cells through many things, right? They're perhaps facilitating metastasis. That's the spread
wow.
of cells from the primary tumor to different parts of the body.
Most
gotcha. Breast cancer deaths, they're not because of the primary tumor, they're because of the metastasis. And so a lot of efforts in the field are really focused on targeting this population of more mesenchymal cells. And so what we're hoping to do is to use immunological approaches to eliminate them. And so that is the dream. That's the vision. We're taking little steps towards it.
Yeah, we don't do giant leaps in science. It's typically a few small steps at a time. And there we are, back to that diversity of thought. Back to why science is for everyone, right? And we love this. So I'm like so thrilled to hear that because your immunology brain is doing all of these good things. And clearly you're doing good things because she refers to her notes that you won the Judy Appleton PhD Early Career Excellence in Research Award. Holy moly. Can you tell me about what this award, I don't know a lot about this award, if you want to share a little bit about the award or share with our audience, and then what this award will do for you, like moving forward, what it's done for you.
Yeah, so this award is thanks to Dr. Jeff Letchworth, who has named this award in honor of Dr. Judy Appleton, who was here at Cornell and has done some really fascinating work in the field of immunology. So I consider myself I'm very grateful for this award, and I'm thankful that I got this at this stage of my career. Because of the generosity of Dr. Letchworth and Dr. Appleton, we now have some funds, and that saves us from waiting from the, you know, the conventional grant review process.
So just briefly, right, for people listening, like it's not like money is just roll it, like there's money everywhere for people to do certain types of research. That's just not the way it goes.
Well, I wish that
right.
was the case, but that's not what happens. We have to
yeah.
grants. We have
yep.
to apply for funding. Some of those are federal funds. Some of them come as pilot funds. Some are endowments. And so as scientists, we constantly need to bring in the money that we're able to do the experiments at the bench. And so the Judy Appleton Award will really facilitate some of that. And because of this very generous gift, I have been able to recruit more students to my lab. It comes at a very critical time in my career as an assistant professor when I'm just starting my lab up. And it allows me to recruit talented graduate students to my lab. It gives me the flexibility to explore different ideas. So we're using these funds in many different ways, not just for recruitment of students, but also in helping us understand mechanistically what is going on in some of these mesenchymal tumors that respond. It's helping us translate some of our work outside of the mouse model. This is a huge benefit of being here at the Veterinary College at Cornell. I also have students, graduate students in my lab who already have DBM degrees or are pursuing DBM together with PhD. And they're interested in translating these findings to canine mammary carcinomas or feline mammary carcinomas.
Yes.
So it really helps us, once again, adopt a very different perspective to this work and help translate it beyond the mouse model and use these funds to really look at mechanism and understand the biology for why this is happening.
That's amazing. Well, congratulations, first of all, because it's quite an achievement. It sounds like it was, obviously, it's for a person that did incredible things, and here you are innovating and doing incredible things at the university. It's allowed you to be more of a mentor to students. You have more students doing good things. And that's another reason why I love the College of Veterinary Medicine, because here you are doing this human side research, let's say, even though it's in a mouse model, which again, that's important also. And then it can translate to these students who will be taking it and maybe doing their own research on the feline and canine side. And as a general practitioner who cuts these out routinely, and in cats, it's very aggressive, actually. It's mind-boggling and just wonderful. And I just want to say, like, thank you. And by the way, if you've looked at her lab site, there is a section called Lab Fun, which I loved because it shows these incredible students. I was like, yes. You can feel free to mention anything about Lab Fun you like before I
So since you've seen the pictures, I can preface it a little bit. And so the lab culture for me is very important. We are scientists and the science is, you know, what keeps us going. But at the end of the day, we're human beings and we work together in the lab. You spend, at least when I was a graduate student, I spent more time in the lab than I did at home.
100%.
My lab, and throughout my, you know, not just as a graduate student, even as a postdoc, right? You spend more time at the bench. And your colleagues are your friends. They're not just your colleagues. Yes, you get intellectual support from them. You get emotional support from them. They're your friends. If you are an international graduate student and you come to the lab, you don't know anyone. Your lab mates are your friends. They were my friends when I came to a different country. And so it's very important for me to foster an environment where people respect each other, where people are good lab citizens. And I really think that eventually will affect the quality of the science. So we make it an effort when we recruit students to recruit not just brilliant scientists, but to recruit individuals who are good lab citizens. And then we just have fun activities where just getting an ice cream. Sometimes it's going on a hike.
I mean, the fun stopped at hiking for me, but I'm on board with ice cream. And if anybody comes to Cornell, you have to go to the Dairy Bar. It's fantastic. But that's amazing because we know that good citizens, I love that term, but people who like to work together and they enjoy not only their work, but their culture and their environment, and they're happy, there's more to the work, even more passion, even more love, even more, because it is long hours.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's long hours and the results are not immediate, right? I mean,
you
have so many failed experiments before something works. And so you don't get, it's not immediate gratification that I do an experiment and at the end of the day, I'm, you know, going to have the answers to all these questions. It's a slow process. It's a difficult process. It requires persistence. And while you do need intellectual support and mentorship for that, you do need your colleagues to talk to about these things because you're not the only one with a failed experiment, right?
Yeah.
A colleague working down the hallway from you probably had 5 failed experiments and everybody is upset. So it's nice to have a community to not just talk about, you know, getting through these difficult times, but also to troubleshoot.
Yeah.
You have 2 people with their Western blots not working and they're not talking to each other.
Yes.
Then they're both going to be upset at their bench and not know what to do. But if these 2 individuals came together and talked, hey, you know, this is what's not working for me and that's not what's working for me, then you troubleshoot the problem together and you find perhaps more than one solution. And that's another reason why having a good lab culture where people communicate with each other is very, very important.
Yes, 100%. It's not you did that wrong. It's I've done that wrong. Here's what I did to fix it. Or here's how maybe we could look at it in your experiment. I love that. And so what does a typical day look like for you? Is there a typical day?
No, there is no typical day. Every day is different. And that's what I love about this job. It's a challenge every day. So my day is, well, so I have a family too. I have a 7-year-old son. And so my day is like split between the lab and home. And so
it
starts with my son and dropping him off to school and spending time with him. And then I come to the lab and in the lab, I mean, it's different on different days. When I'm not teaching, a lot of my time is spent in the lab. I love working with students. I really love mentoring students. So I spend time with all of the students in my lab. I spend time writing grants. I spend time attending seminars or sitting on committees or attending meetings. Yeah.
There's a lot that's involved being at an academic institution for those listening, right? So you have research, you have to, maybe you're giving talks, you're working with your community, you serve on a committee, you're doing, it's not like you're at a desk just doing your research every day.
Absolutely. And I think that's what makes it so exciting, right? It's not just about thinking about the science, but there are so many different aspects to being a good scientist. You have to be good at the bench. You have to be able to communicate your work in written or oral form as presentations or writing grants. You have to serve in the committee. You have to mentor other students. And so my day is, you know, divided doing these different things. And then at the end of my day, I go back home and I switch off and I'm with my son.
She said off, but she goes home to a young child. I'm sure that doesn't sound so easy, but okay.
Yeah. Well, I talk about different things. So maybe I switch off in a different way. So now I'm not talking about EMT anymore, right? We talk about cars and trucks and superheroes and, you know, fun stuff like that. So it's a little different.
That's incredible. Oh, I really appreciate you sharing that. So I love asking a few questions just to get to know these amazing scientists like you on a little bit more of a personal level, not too personal. Here's what I'm going to ask. Just a few quick questions about just like your likes. I call it a little lightning round. But as a nod to Cornell, I actually love when you get to serve on committees and talk to others in the college that are not even in your department, we have more of that diversity of thought. So sometimes I'm like, oh, they just gave me a great idea, right? And I run to kind of go talk about that. Okay, so do you have a favorite restaurant in Ithaca? This is draw people in.
Taste of Thai.
Oh, delicious. Oh, that's solid, solid choice. Does music play in your lab?
I think it plays in individual people's ears.
Okay, so people just get to pick
ear pods on and
listen
to their own thing. But no, we don't have music playing in the lab because I think everybody has different tastes. So
Do you do music when you're at the bench doing, like, are you listening to something?
I love listening to music, but I usually don't listen to it in the lab. I'm one of those people who like to focus with no sound.
I know. So people would be mortified at me. And some of the students, when I'd be teaching, they like love to have something. I need silence when I review stuff.
Yeah.
Don't think I'm a creep, people.
I'm the same. For me, it's very quiet, but I do enjoy listening to music outside the lab.
Do you have a favorite artist?
I like Imagine Dragons. They're my favorite.
Ooh, that's a solid choice. They're on my workout playlist. They're very motivational sometimes.
Love them. Yeah.
And then salty or sweet?
Salty.
Oh, favorite salty snack?
Takis.
Ooh, Takis are good.
Yeah.
Oh, but I think I'd still go sugar. That's incredible. See, she leaves the bench, she goes, gets her Takis, and then she thinks about all these amazing things. I think it's just so neat. And I want to highlight the fact that, again, you're doing all of this amazing research on the human side. And I think sometimes people forget that at a veterinary institution, all sorts of things happen for the good of just humanity, including animals.
I completely agree with you. And I think the advantage of being here at the vet school is that we have access to these other models, right?
Yeah.
Other people don't. And if anything, the canine model for breast cancer or a feline model for breast cancer would model human cancer much more than a mouse model would. The mouse models are great. They're quick. They allow us to, you know, make all these manipulations to understand mechanism. But all the mice are essentially uniform, right? They're all the same. You don't get the diversity in terms of the breed or in terms.
Yeah.
You could engineer that into your system, but the sampling size and the diversity that you would get with samples from a canine or a feline mammary carcinoma is going to be much more and much more representative of what you're likely to get from a human population. And so I'm very, very happy to be here and have students in my lab who can bring that expertise in and, you know, enrich the work that we're doing.
I love that so much. So many good things. I am so thrilled I had the opportunity to talk to you. Dr. Anushka Dongre here at Cornell doing this amazing research. Thank you so much for joining me on our first video, our vodcast. Incredible. You're wonderful.
Thank you so much, Michelle. You're very kind. I mean, I really enjoyed this discussion and
so
I'm really thankful to you for having me as your guest.
Yes. Well, thank you. And thank everybody for listening. And if you are listening, tell your friends that I'm adorable and quite personable, in addition to being an extrovert, and that everyone should give our podcast, AKA now vodcast, a listen and a like and subscribe on your favorite platform. Thank you so much for listening to the Cornell Veterinary Podcast. And we'll talk to you soon.